Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Good Wednesday, everybody. Great to have you with us here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Kia, Hyundai, best in new inventory, great pre-owned inventory with the Sunbury Motors guarantee. And not only that, a great service department that takes care of everything. And they're getting so much business, they need more technicians. So whether you're an experienced technician, an entry-level technician looking for that all-important first job, someone looking for a career change, they would love to hear from you. Stop by in person, apply online at sunburymotors.com, or call Todd at 286-7746. Fun show coming up today, including John Crispin in the next half hour. He'll join us to talk about the state of college sports. Years ago, there was a game that went 33 innings in the minors between the Pawtucket Red Sox and the Rochester Red Wings. Red Sox and Orioles affiliates at the time. Wade Boggs and Cal Ripken Jr. both played in the game. They had to stop it after 32 innings. And then pick it up later and only lasted one inning, it was done. ESPN is putting together a piece on that, and the producer of that 30 for 30 is going to be joining us in just a few minutes here to talk about it. Then John Crispin in the next half hour. Then Tim Newton, the play-by-play voice of Purdue football, will join us at 4:06 today to preview tomorrow's game, which will be an 8:05 kickoff, and we'll be on the air at 6:30 right here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. And in the final half hour today, Neil Coulong on the NFL with cutdown day, Mason Rudolph sticking with the Steelers, Jimmy Garoppolo is still with the 49ers, all that and more coming up on the show today. Should be a lot of fun and very informative as well. We'll have a best-of show tomorrow. I'm just going to put my feet up in the hotel room and do nothing. There will be no games to watch tomorrow, so I guess I'll be doing nothing. But at the same time, there's certain times I have to be in the stadium and so forth. So we'll have a best-of show tomorrow and then back with you live on Friday. That's why we had the high school football roundtable yesterday. So the producer of the 30 for 30 on the longest game is coming up in a few moments. Then John Crispin next half hour. Tim Newton, the play-by-play voice of Purdue at 4:06. And in the final half hour, Neil Coulon. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors. 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. Let's bring in Nellie Gillis now, producer of the ESPN 30 for 30, the longest game. Nellie, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Well, I remember this.
You do?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I remember it because it took place at Old McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, right?
Yeah,
so,
I did.
All right. So let's start with the basics. It's amazing who's in the game, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not only that, it's also amazing who's managing the game, which is a different part of it. So let's talk about two Hall of Famers that are in the game, Nellie.
Yeah. So on the Pawtucket Red Sox, we've got Wade Boggs at third base.
Yeah.
And we interviewed him for our story, and it is incredible the extent. I mean, after a career like his, he still remembers this night and this game, I mean, as if it were yesterday. It's really remarkable. So, of course, he went on to, you know, have a 17, 18-year career with the Boston Red Sox and the Yankees really hit his stride, you know, as a punch and Judy hitter, as he says. but at this point, he is a minor leaguer. You know, he's been with the Paw Sox for a couple of years. He's doing well. He's a 300-plus hitter. You know, people really rely on him to drive people home. He's not a home run hitter. You know, he hits stuff to the outfield, and he hits base hits. He hits doubles. He gets people home, and that's what he did this night. You know, he really had a phenomenal night. He tells a story, which we couldn't include in the piece, but he tells a story of calling his father the next morning and telling him that he had four hits in the game and his dad was impressed. And then he reveals that it was 12 at bats.
Yes.
And he was 4 for 12 and his dad's a little less impressed. But
Well, but it turns out, okay, that's a 333 night, and that's a Wade Boggs night. And he probably had chicken.
Wade Boggs night.
And he probably had chicken before the game, too, right?
Yeah, he did. And he also he would dig in the dirt at the home plate. He had all these superstitions. This was a little bit pre all of the superstitions, but he had just begun developing them. So he did start drawing his sign in the dirt at home plate. So he's on the Chicago Red Sox, and then on the Rochester
Cal Red Wings. Ripken Jr. is on the other side, and he had a 2-hit night.
I know. I think he had a 1-hit night on the long night, and then 2 months later when they finished the game, he had his second hit. But he, too, this guy, Hall of Fame for playing 2,131 games in a row, that streak that he has later in his career. And still interviewing him, he looks back to this night and he remembers that it was so cold that they started these fires in these big metal trash cans and they would burn the broken bats. And he even remembers, and who knows whether this is whether his memory serves, but he remembers even taking some hunks of wood off of the bench in the dugout and burning that just to stay warm.
Amazing, because we have a minor league team, the State College Spikes here. Roger LaFrançois was the hitting coach here for 2 years. He's the catcher.
No kidding.
He's the catcher in this game.
Yeah, he's the catcher.
And I've talked to Roger about this game. It's amazing.
That's incredible.
The pitchers, Luis Aponte, okay, major leaguer. Bruce Hurst, okay, won 2 games of the World Series. Bobby Ojeda, who pitched for the Mets, he's the winner. I mean, these are all like guys that played in this game.
Yeah.
Rich Gedman caught.
Yeah. It's really striking to me when you look at a game like in the minors, for those that don't know the minors really well, the kind of mix of talent you have. You have veterans of baseball that have been up and down, people that have been in the minors for 5 or 6 years, people who've been called up to replace somebody with an injury, but then sent back down, or someone who got called up, but didn't do very well and sent back down. And then you've got these like young, striving, right out of college, these kids basically who are so talented, it's like the Cal Ripkens at this age. They're super young. They're the golden boys. Like they're going to make it like no matter what. And I think that is so interesting, that like mix in the minors of the people for whom this is just a step onto their big career. And for those where this is their peak, and this is as high as they'll get.
And the manager was Joe Morgan, who created
Morgan Magic
in 1988. He did that. He was the manager for Pawtucket. And what's interesting is that in this game, Pawtucket ties the game in the ninth. And in the 21st, Rochester goes ahead. And Pawtucket scores, finally, again, in the bottom of the 21st.
That, to me, as remarkable as 33 innings is, to me, the 21st in the middle of the night to me is like the best part of this story. In our documentary for ESPN 3330, we have this moment where Cal Ripken says like we scored and when Rochester scores in the top of the 21st, it's scored by a guy named Dave Huppert, who is the catcher for the Red Wings. And this is his first ever AAA hit. He's never even gotten a AAA hit, but he gets his first AAA hit at 2 o'clock in the morning with 20 people in the stands to go ahead and to potentially win the game. And they really thought they'd won it at that point. At 21st inning, 2:30 in the morning, the score is 2-1. Rochester's like, thank God, we finally did it. And then the bottom of the 21st comes up and this first baseman for the Pawtucket Red Sox is a guy named Dave Koza.
Yep.
And he's a good hitter. He's a really, really good hitter. And he comes up and he's like, all I got to do is I just got to get on base. you know, just get me on base. And he gets on base, and then Wade Boggs comes up after him and drives him home. And it's like the absurdity of that to tie the game at 21 innings in the middle of the night is really crazy. Yeah, so then they keep playing. They keep going.
Well, what about Jim Umbarger? He pitches 10 innings in relief. Right? Yeah. He's not the starter. He pitches 10 innings in relief in this game, which is remarkable in its own count. And by the way, throws a shutout over the 10 innings.
Oh, yeah. No scoring. Someone said to me, so on this story, we worked with a guy named Dan Barry, who wrote a book about this game called Bottom of the 33rd, which if folks have not read it, is for every baseball fan and honestly non-baseball fans alike. It is a fabulous, fabulous book. And we interviewed him for our story, and he said something about Jim Umbarger that was like, he probably pitched the best game of his career that night, but it was from 1:30 to 3 a.m. or something. And there were 20 people there to see it, and there were no scouts. You know, there was nobody there
right.
to really, but he goes down in history as being part of this game. And yeah, it's a remarkable night with remarkable players.
It's early in the season. It's like April 18, 19, somewhere around there. And so there's a whopping 1,740 at McCoy. All right. Now, they finally decided 4 in the morning, all right, I think we're delirious. We need to stop. So they're going to pick the game up again. And they had offered to move it, if I recall, to Fenway Park, if I recall the story right. But because of the baseball strike, they said, we really can't cross the line.
Yep, that's but, right.
Right. So when they do pick it up, the place is sold out.
It's crazy. The scene, I mean, the painting of the picture is like these guys have played 8 hours in the freezing cold. It's like April, and April in New England is cold. You know, it's like 40 yeah. in the 40s, and it's windy, super, super windy, which was why there wasn't a lot of scoring. Like every ball that would have been a homer, you know, ended up being a pop-up and, you know, all the rest of it. So they leave the stadium at 4 o'clock in the morning. And if you want to hear the story about why they played till 4 a.m., I'm happy to go into
please,
it. You
please,
want to hear that story?
Please, yes.
So on this night, like for baseball fans, I think we don't know a lot necessarily about the rules and about the rule books, and like especially when it just comes to the logistics on a game. But the rule book for the International League and for many baseball leagues is that there's a curfew.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically say if you're still tied at a certain point in the night, we'll suspend the game. We'll just stop play and we'll pick it up at another day. And usually that curfew, at least in the International League, it was at 12:50 in the morning. And that means that, like, if an inning's already started, you finish that inning, but you don't play another one, right? You're done. And for some reason, nobody really knows why, in the manual for the umpires in 1981, there was a paragraph missing.
Oh.
That paragraph existed in the 1980 manual. It existed in the 1982 manual. But for some reason in 1981, a typist, a secretary, somebody left it out of the book. And so when the umpires get to 12:50 in the morning and the managers and general managers and the players are all like, well, we're still tied, but at least we'll pause. You know, it's 12:50. The umpires say, nah, you know, it's not in our book. And this book is like their Bible. I mean, this is what they go by. They are just, it's the word is gold. That's it. And so they keep playing. And the two teams are beside themselves. They are desperate to get the game called and suspended. And so they start calling all of the higher-ups in the International League, including this guy, Harold Cooper, who's the president. Mm. And he lives in Ohio. And finally, he doesn't pick up the phone for like 3 hours. And finally, at 4 o'clock in the morning, they get a hold of him at home. They either think he was sleeping or he was out drinking, and they're not sure which. But they finally get a hold of him at 4 a.m., and he says, all right, you gotta suspend the game. And that's why they called it off then. But otherwise, they would have gone into extra innings, and at 12:50, they would have suspended it, and they would have gone home and played a doubleheader the next day, you know. But yeah, but to your point about the 33rd, they leave this night after playing 8 hours and 32 innings, and they're freezing cold and exhausted, and there are not many people left. I think there were 19 left at the end of the night. And they're just spent, but they know it was remarkable. They just are having kind of a hard time feeling that it was remarkable because they're so miserable. And 2 months later, they come back, and the stadium is packed with 6,000 people.
Yep.
And there are reporters from all over the world, Tokyo, Japan, you know, like BBC, London was there, Armed Forces Radio, all over the States. And MLB was on strike. So now all these baseball reporters have nothing to write about.
Right.
So they all come flooding to Little McCoy Stadium in Second, Rhode Island to report on the 33rd inning. It was a pretty remarkable night.
By the way, we mentioned Joe Morgan. He didn't see the end of the night because he got tossed in the game. He got thrown out in the 21st inning or 22nd inning or something like that. And then there's the reliever, Luis Aponte, who gets home at whatever hour in the morning and gets into a fight with his wife because she doesn't believe that the game went that long.
Yeah, there was a lot. You know, this was the era before cell phones and before
yes.
internet, before everything else. So there are all these people here in the stadium, and none of their family know where they are, right? So as it gets later and later, the absurdity of the night really, really starts to, like, kick in. And we have in our piece for 30 for 30, which I hope folks will listen to because it's a really,
yes.
it's a great story. There's all of these nuggets of from the fans, from the scorekeeper, from the umpires, and the people calling the ballpark are like, some of them are quite worried. You know, it's been hours. Their loved ones were supposed to be home at 11 o'clock, you know, and now it's 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. Some of it's hysterical. I mean, there's like the bat boy whose mother came to the ballpark to bring him home and he refused to leave. There's, you know, great, great story. Joe Morgan's wife, Dottie. Joe Morgan tells the story of Dottie calling the ballpark saying, "You're out drinking, aren't you?" And he's like, "No, I swear, we're still playing baseball. I promise." Yeah.
Well, Aponte said to his wife, said, "Look, when the morning paper comes out, you'll see I'm telling the truth." Well, the game ended so late, it didn't make the paper. It wasn't until Monday.
Right. Yeah, I chatted with one of the reporters who, you know, he was like, there was no Sunday print for the local paper. And then for the Providence paper, he missed the deadline because the game went so long, so he couldn't get his story in order to make the time for the print the next day. So, yeah, most of the news came out on Monday morning.
How fascinating was it? And has it been for you to learn about all the nuances of this 8-hour and 25-minute marathon?
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. I would say not to be corny about it, but it felt like the game was an odyssey, and certainly reporting on it has been an odyssey. You know, I think what's most interesting to me about a game like this is what it says about the minors in a bigger picture and what it says about baseball.
Nellie Gillis, that's incredible. Thank you so much. It's a podcast to go with the ESPN 30 for 30 on the longest game. Nellie Gillis joining us on the show today. John Crispin next here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Great to have you with us. Brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. And with that, we bring in former Nittany Lion and now with ESPN, John Crispin. John, great to have you back.
Hey, man. My pleasure. Was that a Little League promo on the way in because of Williamsport and all that stuff?
You know what? They've used it for a long time because for 14 years I coached a Little League. I butchered a lot of careers.
I bet.
I figured out.
Poor kids.
I figured out very quickly I should be announcing it. Sure.
Wait, were you pre pitch count? Like, did you have an 11-year-old throwing 150 pitches in like 2 days?
If I needed to win, no, I'm just kidding.
Atta boy. Come on, Nolan Ryan did it.
I did
40.
You know what? I did everything to make sure, like, at least in my own, I did it by feel. And you know what?
I think Randy's
kind of done for. You know, Randy threw a lot of pitches in the second and third. I think he's kind of done for the night. Let's go with somebody else.
Walter Matthau's? Was it Brubaker?
Yeah, Brubaker in the dugout. Bad News Bears.
Yeah. That's kind of who you were, right? You know, you give the kids a six pack to ice his arm.
Well, one, I'll tell you, I was managing in an All-Star game. And it was just, okay, it was against the team that was going to actually be representing the league. They just wanted us to play against them to give them a tune-up game.
Oh, nice. Right. That's who you were. Tune-up team.
My entire life is a tune-up. Right? And to be honest with you, we beat the daylights out of them 24-8.
Oh, wow.
Okay, now I'm just,
backfired.
I didn't do anything. I did nothing except run the lineup up, except for one thing. I'm standing there, and they're relaying their signs to the pitcher. And I'm just leaning against the dugout. And I'll be honest with you.
Are you banging some pots and pans?
I didn't have to bang any pots and pans. I'm on the first base side. Almost all my hitters are right-handed. So
Joey Cora out in the outfield.
So, I had Carlos Beltran was my center fielder. It was great.
Yep.
You know, A.J. Hinch was my bench coach. It was great. And so when it was over with, their manager's a great guy. He says, "What did we do wrong?" I said, "Mike, you got to disguise all your signs."
Yeah.
He says, "You can't do it in the open like that," because I said, "If somebody as stupid as me can figure it out, somebody else smarter is going to be able to do it." You know, and that was the whole purpose of the game. They needed to find out what they could and couldn't do. You know.
Well, you did that. You're such a giver like that, Steve.
Oh, yeah. No, like, oh, okay. Because it didn't matter if we won. You know what I mean? It was just we played to play. All right, so.
You would have never heard my brother say that. It didn't matter if we won. Now, it may not matter if you win, but it certainly matters if you lose. Do you know what I mean? Like, some people don't like to lose, Steve. Joe's one of those people.
Yeah, and also the fact that he scored, too.
Yes.
They had to be a combination. They won and he scored.
Yeah. Well, MVP of the game, you know, most text messages these days. Like, he still requires it. He still plays at a men's league, dude. My brother, and I know we're going to talk about our show coming up, but my brother, he still plays men's league games and still gets mad at officials. I mean, you're talking about guys that are making, like, $15 a game.
Oh, jeez.
And Joe hit him with the, like, "You gotta give me that. Like, I used to do this for a living." And I just can't help but to laugh. Like, Steve, that's going to have to be an episode of one of our shows.
And the show, by the way, is the coach and the commentator.
Yeah.
And two of my favorite people going out there who agree on more than they realize, but disagree on many other things.
So here's the thing. So Joe and I, we come from the same foundation, right?
Yep.
We are family people first. We love our family.
You are Sue Crispin's sons.
We are. And I moved two blocks from my childhood home. Joe moved three blocks from our childhood home. And Joe and I's backyard connects. So the conversations we're going to have on air for an hour, they already happened multiple times a day through the backyard.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's he's coming over to steal something from my fridge or get a drink. He can't buy his own beer, apparently. Yuengling is only available in my house. So, like, it's just little thing. Or, like, it was a rough game.
So far,
have any bourbon?
So far, there's no shocks here. Go ahead.
Yes. So we already have these conversations, and we find ourselves arguing, yet we're both saying the same thing. Yet our pride, our ego, whatever it is, it forces us to argue. And I'm like, gosh, we're those people on Twitter. But we do it in a very, like, cordial, quasi-respectful, no, I don't think you're hearing me right. No, I don't think you're hearing me right kind of way. Because we start in the same place. We end up in the same place. But how we got there is so different.
I mean,
and I think that's what's interesting.
Yeah.
The process of realization, the process of calculating all these factors and scenarios and coming out with the algorithm. How is 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 equals whatever? And 15 plus 12 plus, somehow we get to the same number.
Well, what gets me is the two of you will talk and go back and forth for 7 or 8 minutes because I've been a party to this, obviously.
Yes.
And at the end, he'll say, well, I do see where John's coming from. And I'm like,
well,
okay.
That's usually because I'm right.
That usually helps. Like,
so, Steve, here's the other thing, and I'll say this while Joe's not on the air. Joe's a smart guy.
Yes, he
right?
is. Yes, he is.
He's a smart guy. He's driven, right? I'm more along the lines of motivated and intelligent. I'm not smart. I don't do the smart thing. Like, for crying out loud, I'm making a career in broadcasting. That is not smart. Like, now, I'm a little
calculated. Jeez, I've done this for 45 years. I'm feeling worse by the second.
Yeah, you should. But if you're in my position at this point in my life with my career, you know, society is what it is. Like, job security in this business ain't easy.
No, it's not.
Especially when we have the expectation of, oh, I want to be called in the game day game. It's like, all right, well, then you're setting yourself up for failure.
Right.
It's like Joe's smart, but he's also driven. So he stays on track a lot better than I do. Sometimes I'm out to lunch, man. I'm in a hot air balloon in the middle of the day, and I'm just like, oh, I forgot. I got a round of golf to get back. But I always get what I need to get done, and I'm always studied. I'm calculated. So our approach is very different. We'll end up in the same place. Again, my motivations make me a little, you know, free-thinking at times. Joe's drive always keeps him on track. It's fascinating to be around them. Sometimes it drives me nuts, but you know, we'll probably have some stories, like stories of Jerry Dunn telling everybody that the very first practice we had, 5 minutes into practice, he looks over and there's balls flying all over the place. And it was because I wasn't giving him good enough passes, as if that's why he was missing his shots. Like,
oh,
unbelievable.
I know. I was there. I was a witness. But what's interesting is that he'll come at it from the idea of a coach and how to handle kids.
Yeah.
You can come at it from the angle of you go to a lot of campuses during the course of the year and you see a lot of other coaches and a lot of other kids at different levels that gives a balanced perspective as to what it's like there, and there.
Yes.
Versus what it's like for him.
Well, and I always say to Joe, I said, that's great, but what happens when you have to modify your reality? He goes, what do you mean? I go, every situation is its own reality. And in so many ways, you have to modify your approach for that reality. And I was like, I understand you want to do a certain thing. You want to do A, B, C, and D, but sometimes you got to skip a step and you've got to plant some seeds. You got to plant the seed that is C and D and just jump ahead to E. You really, in today's day, I refer to this as adjustability. It's not a word, but it's my word. You've got to have adjustability. And some would say it's adaptability. It's not adaptability. It's adjustability. Because you still continue down the path that you want to continue on, the purpose, the drive, the motivation, whatever you want to call it. But you have to be prepared to just adjust. Make an adjustment along the way. That's the biggest challenge. I challenge Joe on that all the time because I say that's what the greatest coaches do. They adjust. They don't adapt because sometimes the adaptation changes who you are. They just adjust within the framework of themselves. So I think those are things that when we get into, they're challenging questions that actually expose a lot of knowledge.
I'll
you're going to see a lot of knowledge from Joe. I think it'll be fun.
one thing that I would ask Joe is that on his better teams, because he, you know, you would have talent. Did he feel like he coached less and got more out of it?
I would ask
him that question. Because, I mean, look, sometimes you don't have a great team. You do, like, try to find every little conceivable thing to get whatever ounce of juice you can squeeze out of that orange.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then you've got talent. And guess what? You find that the talent takes over. And by doing, you don't overcoach them. By doing a little bit less, you get more.
Well,
and I would ask him that question.
We say it all the time. Like, sometimes with the better teams, you have to help them get out of their own way.
Yes. Yes.
Right? And,
yes.
And in that process, coaches realize they're doing the same thing to themselves.
Yeah.
Where they're saying, I have to help myself get out of my own way. Yeah. I want to overcoach these guys because I feel responsible for this highly talented group. Like, I always say, look,
The job is not
an opportunity. It's a responsibility.
But that's the insecurity.
It's the responsibility that makes it hard. Well, it's the insecurity of it, but it's also the I'm looking for security part of it.
Right.
Meaning I'm looking to stabilize my career and develop some job security by taking advantage of a really good team.
Yeah.
And so it is philosophically, it's one of the hardest things to really grasp. And ultimately, it's the guys that have conviction and peace. And that peace isn't coming from how significant you are. The peace ultimately comes from how insignificant you are. How little you really matter actually helps you the most as a coach. Where you get focused on the things that you actually have to do well to maximize the potential of your group, as opposed to all the things that you think you have to do that don't really maximize the potential of anything. It just makes it more complicated. Like Joe's term, our term, we're big into this book called Anti-Fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
we are all about making kids, teams, people, ourselves, anti-fragile, which allows us to thrive in any situation.
Yes.
Fearless, convicted, and okay with failure because it's that failure that makes us. So I think it's really interesting to see that actually, you know, come together because there are times where it doesn't really look the way you want it to look.
Yeah. Well, but here's the perspective, though. Joe stayed all 4 years. Joe knows what it's like to be in the NBA.
Yep.
He knows what it's like to play in Europe. He knows what it's like to coach. You know what it's like to play in college. But in this era of the transfer portal, you also know what it's like to think the grass is greener on the other side.
Yeah.
And there's a perspective you can't put a price on with that. Is that fair?
So the other, undoubtedly. Now, I would also say that because I left, I also know what makes Penn State special more so than anybody else.
Yeah, true.
Because I had it and lost it, right? Like,
hey, well,
I know how special it is because I had it and I lost it. And funny enough, I still come back and it's still there. That's why that's why this place is so special. But our perspectives are
and you get, and by the way, you get treated like you never left.
Yeah, no, it took a while.
I know it took a while.
It took a while.
Well, it didn't change. So, I mean, but
no,
But I'm telling you, I mean, now I don't think people realize you even left.
No, and the truth of the matter was, I think they've gone over it because they realized I wasn't that good anyway.
Oh, you
like if I had gone, honestly, no, but think about this, Steve. If I had gone to UCLA and started every single game and scored 1,000 points in 2 years and it was in the first round draft pick, Penn State people would be so annoyed with me.
Yeah.
But I went there, had 5 foot surgeries, played for 2 different coaches, had two of the worst years of school history for basketball at UCLA. So I think for the most part, you look back and go, hey, you wasn't that good anyway. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah, except I can tell everybody that you were good, but it just turned out circumstances kept you from being better.
Yeah, but you know what I needed, Steve? You know this. What did I need that I got in L.A.? It was humility, man.
Yeah,
like
I know.
I needed it. I really did. I needed it. Joe didn't need that. He was so driven and so motivated to prove that he belonged from day one. You know, he was the guy that they should have never recruited. And we'll tell that story, man. People don't realize Joe Crispin, the golden boy of Penn State
Fairfield.
Basketball, was the guy they never should have recruited. He was William and Mary Fairfield at best.
Yep. He was Fairfield. You were recruited by everybody.
Yeah, a lot of that had to do with the fact that I was an athlete. I had 35 dunks my junior year and shot threes from half court, and Joe had already done it in the Big Ten. So all of a sudden you look at it and you say, well, Joe's doing it in the Big Ten, and this guy's more athletic. So, yeah, I was going to be, you know, more of a someone to recruit. But Joe proved himself at every level. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Penn State people loved him and really looked at him as a big piece of the identity of the program, I think it fueled his fire. And he wanted nothing but to serve that institution well. And I think he did. And there's a reason why we want to come back and do what we're doing, starting with a show. And now, yeah, you know, and I'll say this on your show, where do you think Joe Crispin wants to end up?
Well, I know where he wants to end up.
Right?
So I mean,
now I'm not supposed to say that on my show. Joe already told me I'm not allowed to say that on our show.
Right. But
you
know
at the
what?
Same time, let's just be real. Like
his first week in practice. So I want to at least see like 3-4 days of practice before I really come to some conclusions.
Yeah.
I walked out of there and I was working with Frank Ardina at the time.
Yep.
I said, the Crispin kid is something we've never seen here. And
yep.
he said, well, Frank, well, I said, Frank, I said, it's something we haven't seen. You know, 1,900 and what, 18 points later?
Yeah. Well, and then you add two crazies on the floor at the same time. Hey. Now, I always say, Steve, we were crazy before crazy became cool. Right? Like,
yeah,
the way we played, we were crazy, but we were crazy before crazy became cool. Now it's like, oh, yeah, everybody who shoots 20% from three shoots from 30.
Well,
you know, we did it when you were not supposed to do that. We risked getting benched to take shots. And I think that's what made us fun.
But you also knew you weren't confrontational. But this is a story I've never told, so I'll tell it now. Right, we're on the plane, the plane trip going in, remember going to New Orleans, and we got bounced and thrown all over the place.
Yep.
And the guy talks
yep.
about the fuel and the whole deal, right?
Yep. Critical level of fuel. Steve.
Yeah, critical level of fuel. Fine, he lands the plane right over Lake Pontchartrain. The part I never told, right, is we get on the bus to go to the hotel downtown, and of course. Which two people are sitting next to each other? You and me.
Yeah.
And he leans over to me. He says, can I talk to you for a second? I said, sure, John, go ahead. He says, look, Jerry's like, he's really uptight. He says, and he says, we need him to somehow get off our back.
Yep.
Right. And so what did I say to you? I said, all right, I'll talk to him. So then I went in and I talked to Jerry. I said, boy, I said, you're in a great spot. He says, I said, you know what I'm going to say. I said,
everybody's picking you to lose.
Right? I said, you went to Kentucky and beat Kentucky. You beat Temple. You beat Pitt. You went to the ECAC Holiday Festival. You won that. You went to Ohio State and won. You went yep. to Michigan State and you beat them at the United Center. I said, you've beaten all the top teams in the country. I said, that's one hell of a team you got there. I said,
yeah.
I said, and you know what? The cool thing is you know it, they know it, nobody else does. I said, you guys, you all have fun. So whatever he goes in, and I guess he told you guys that thing verbatim.
Yep.
Because John yep. comes out to me, he says, did you tell him about the Kentucky Holiday Festival, Ohio State, Michigan
yep.
State thing? I go, yeah, he goes, that's the speech we got.
Yep. Look, we were such a great team.
But you knew if you told me, I'd tell him.
Who all the players were.
But you
think about that.
Right.
That was our team. You were on our team, and we didn't even know that you were one of the players. You were just one of the family members that was always with us. And I'm telling you, you take Frank Gardenia off the call of the Kentucky
yep.
game, and it's just not the same.
That's right. That's right. It's not. That's right. It's not.
ESPN Plus.
Frankie G, baby.
Super low def.
Frankie,
super low def.
Frankie G. Hey, the show's going to be great. Coach and the commentator. It's going to be fabulous. Looking forward to it. And just to hear your voice on with us is always great. Thanks for being on the show with us today.
My pleasure. And yeah, we're looking forward to getting started next week. It's going to be a blast.
Thanks, John.
All right, we'll talk to you, Steve.
ESPN's John Christman. Coming up in the next half hour, the play-by-play voice of Purdue football, Tim Newton. Today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us today on this Wednesday here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.